Okay. Comrades, yesterday we talked about the life and ideas of Friedrich Engels, who made a very important contribution to Marxism, particularly in the field of philosophy and the relationship between Marxist philosophy and nature and science. And Engels wrote a very profound statement, actually, in his book Anti-During, where he talked about dialectics, the philosophy of Marxism, dialectical materialism. And he said, "Dialectics is the science of the general laws of motion and development of nature, human society, and thought." Now, that's basically to say everything. Dialectics is a philosophy that can allow us to look at all different aspects of what's going on in the world. What is dialectics? Well, we talked about it, a bit about it yesterday. Dialectics is an ancient Greek philosophy arising originally from Heraclitus, who's quite a mystical kind of philosopher, who wrote lots of kind of aphorisms, basically along the lines of everything changes. That was pretty much how you can sum up his philosophy. And he famously said, you can never step into the same river twice. And this idea of a dynamic philosophy that expressed change was developed by Hegel in the 18th and 19th century, the German philosopher Hegel. And basically it's the idea that everything changes, everything flows. And as Hegel said, the only real constant is change itself. Everything is relative and everything is interconnected. And that's another fundamental part of dialectics. And the point is that we have to look not at static things, at isolated events, but to understand phenomena as processes, as relationships. And in this respect, we say that formal logic, the kind of logic that we're traditionally used to, is not wrong, but it's limited, it's truncated. And dialectics is a higher form of logic that looks not at isolation, but at movement. It's like the difference, if you like, in mathematical terms, between algebra and calculus. One just gives you a static picture, the other a moving picture. But the dialectics of Hegelianism was very idealistic. It was basically Hegel had the idea that dialectics kind of existed as laws separate and external to the world. It existed in their own world of ideas. And that dialectics were somehow, therefore, external to nature, something imposed on nature. And actually, it took Marx and Engels, as was mentioned yesterday as well, to turn dialectics on its head, so to speak, and to give it a materialist grounding, in which we see dialectics not as something imposed on nature, not something external to nature, but as something that we can observe in nature. It's a generalized laws of motion of nature, as Engels points out. And Engels outlined the kind of these laws of motion, if you like, in his books Anti-During and Dialectics of Nature in particular. And he gave specific examples in relation to nature. He said, you start off fundamental, actually, to dialectics, the idea of quantity and quality. And he gives the example of basically things in nature we see, processes where change doesn't occur all, you know, linear and smoothly, but in you know, building up beneath the surface, accumulations of change beneath the surface that express themselves suddenly in qualitative change. And the example famously he gives is of phase transitions, the idea that between 0 and 100 degrees, water can change in temperature, but you don't notice any fundamental difference in the quality and the property of that water at all. It just gets hotter or colder. Obviously, below 0 degrees, it turns into ice, and above 100 degrees, it turns into a steam. And you see fundamental changes in the properties of the substance. Another kind of law of dialectics that Engels gave was the idea of unity of opposites. And particularly, you can see that in nature today, the idea of attraction and repulsion. The fact that these kind of things that seemingly are mutually antagonistic to one another, in fact, have to exist in a kind of unity. They're completely interrelated. We see that in science, the idea of the atom, the fact that there's obviously attraction that keeps the atom together, but at the same time, repulsion that stops it just from completely collapsing in on itself. Another kind of unity of opposites we see frequently that Engels talks about is the idea of simplicity and complexity, or order and chaos, if you like. The idea that these aren't, again, mutually exclusive to one another, but actually coexist and condition one another. and that actually from chaotic processes, things that seem completely random and complex, actually very simple laws can be derived. For example, the ideal gas laws that were developed by Boyle and others early on, I think in the 17th century, where they showed that actually although the kind of motion of molecules is completely chaotic, you can still talk about properties, about laws that relate the volume and pressure and temperature within a cylinder of gas. In other words, we see a simplicity arising out of complexity, an order out of chaos. And Engels makes the point that there's also an interrelation of opposites when it comes to truth and error. Every truth, if you like, is only relative. All our scientific models are approximations, if you like, and always contain certain limitations, certain errors. But at the same time, every erroneous idea always contains a kernel of truth within it as well. And in fact, there can be no real idea that's expressed in society that doesn't express some truth, that doesn't express some reality of the world. Otherwise, why would anyone ever come up with such an idea in the first place? Even the kind of ideas such as God that we create are obviously based on, you know, anthropomorphic images of man and have some sort of relation to a real thing that we experience in the real world. The third law that Engels points out in relation to dialectics is the idea of the negation of the negation. The fact that development is not linear, but actually precisely progressive. You have progress through contradiction. And he gives the example of evolution itself, of an oak and an acorn. The fact that within an acorn is all the genetic material for an oak tree. But within every generation, you also have mutations that gives rise to evolutions. And from that oak tree itself, many more acorns are given birth, and you have a growth in the population. Now, this idea of the negation applies to thought itself, not just on the individual level in terms of consciousness of individuals, but also on a societal level in terms of the theories and the knowledge that we accumulate as a society. And you can see many examples of this in science, the way that science hasn't progressed in a smooth and linear way, but through sharp turns and sudden changes in our theories, in the models that we use. A good example often given is that of light. The fact that Newton originally had an idea of what we called corpuscles of light, particles of light that travelled in an ether. But this idea was negated by the discovery that light was a wave. And this discovery by Young and Huygens kind of revolutionised our view of light. But then Einstein in the early 20th century then negated this again and showed that light in fact was made up of photons, small packets, small quanta of energy that actually displayed both particle and wave-like properties. Now, Thomas Kuhn, a kind of philosopher and historian of science and a scientist himself, actually wrote a very profound book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, which looked precisely at this idea of how science changes in these sudden ways, in this dialectical way, where Kuhn explained you have a kind of an accumulation of knowledge and facts within a certain theoretical framework, what he called a paradigm. But then over time, errors and kind of anomalies build up within our picture of science. As we delve deeper and deeper, we notice things that don't fit with our current models, with our current theories. And therefore, at a certain point, the accumulation of errors and so forth bursts through and a new theory has to replace the old, whilst keeping all the correctness of that previous theory, has to also be able to explain the new observations that we have. And he called this a scientific revolution, a paradigm shift, which has become kind of quite commonplace language nowadays, but was a very profound idea at the time. And Kuhn specifically made the analogy with social revolutions, the fact that there are, within science, a layer that builds up that has a kind of vested interest in the old theories, in the old ideas, and that they have to kind of be swept aside and overcome in order to take things forward. A good example is the question of Galileo, who had to actually fight very hard against the conservatism of the church in order to establish the idea of heliocentrism, the idea that the sun was the centre of the solar system and not the earth. And it's for this kind of reason of the vested interest, the layer of science that we have to kind of the scientists that stand in the way of actually development, that shows why actually a lot of scientific revolutions actually come from outside of the initial scientific community itself, the established scientific community. Einstein being a very famous example, working not in the scientific community but actually in a patent office at the time that he came up with many of his most famous theories. Now, one of the most revolutionary periods in terms of science, what's actually called now the scientific revolution, was a period starting with Copernicus and the idea of our place in the universe, developed through the philosophers of people like Bacon and Descartes, who came up with empiricism and rationalism as a kind of method for science. And ending with really in the 17th century with the discoveries by Newton of the laws of motion. These were all collectively kind of referred to as a scientific revolution, which precisely came about in social conditions when the old feudal regimes, the old feudal order was starting to disintegrate and give, people were looking for rational explanations, material explanations, rather than just idealistic ones for the way in which nature worked. And Newton's discoveries were very revolutionary for the time. The ideas of his laws of motion were very materialistic, actually, in that what he was trying to explain was there is a general law of motion to all of matter, and that general laws could describe all the different motions that we see in nature. And in that sense, it gave a certain kind of materialist oneness to nature, showing that the same general dynamics apply to all matter and phenomena. And like I say, it's very revolutionary for the time, but actually, by the 19th century, Engels points out many of the limitations of this kind of Newtonian framework, pointing out that it's very mechanical and very one-sided. Like, if you ever study kind of Newton's laws in physics or engineering, all that's ever talked about is isolated systems, things that kind of exist separate from the rest of the world, if you like, that we manipulate. And we talk about forces, things that seem to be external to that system, acting on it and causing motion. And all of that, it basically very heavily tinged by Newton's own kind of religious ideas. The idea that, you know, ultimately the one person who set all of this motion into play and comes to the whole universe, what this eternal motion that he saw, very static and kind of rigid view of motion where, you know, it's the eternal repetition of the planets orbiting the sun and so forth. All of this it's tinged with this kind of religious idealism. There's also a very deterministic and kind of fatalistic viewpoint that runs from this. The idea of a clockwork universe, the fact that these are perfect laws, if you like, that have been set in motion, and that if only we knew the initial conditions and the exact velocities of all the particles in the world, famous idea of Laplace's demon, this godly figure who could predict all the future society, all the future nature and course of history, if only you knew the initial conditions that you were working with. And so what you had with Newton was, a very mechanical way of looking at change, a very mechanical way of looking at motion. And in fact, what you can say really is that it was a discussion on an idea of motion that actually excluded change in many respects, that it was there was no room for development, no room for evolution and change in a kind of qualitative sense in Newton's ideas. And it actually took a kind of second scientific revolution, the 19th century, with many of the developments based around the Industrial Revolution, the research into energy, into heat, into light, into electricity, all of these things which actually helped to show the limitations of the Newtonian paradigm. They showed that matter does fundamentally change, that there is a development. You know, previously, all of these kind of phenomena in society, to explain them, there was a very idealistic way of explanation. It just revolved around, you know, forces and powers and spirits and these sorts of things, substances. Electricity was due to electrical forces. If something was hot, it was because it possessed something called the vis calorifica, the hot force, if you like. And there was a cold force if something was cold. In other words, that rather than actually explaining phenomena, basically things were just assigned substances or forces, and it's very similar actually to animism, the idea of explaining phenomena in nature just by inventing as many spirits as there are phenomena that we can't explain. But all of this research in the 19th century showed that actually all of these phenomena, electricity, heat, and so forth, fundamentally came down to the idea of matter in motion. We see that heat itself is kinetic energy of particles. We see that electricity is the motion of electrons. And there was fundamental breakthroughs in terms of the idea of the conservation of energy, the idea that, that motion, that energy itself, can't actually be created or destroyed, but merely changes form. And Einstein developed this even more to show that fundamentally mass and energy were also interchangeable. And in this sense, we get a sense, therefore, that, that energy is no longer something separate, that we can't talk about forces and these external things to nature. But really the fundamental task of science is to explain the phenomena of nature through the idea of matter in motion and how that matter interrelates and interacts with other matter. And it was Engels who pointed this out in Anti-Turing, saying that, that motion is the mode of existence of matter. Never anywhere has there been matter without motion, nor can there be. Matter without motion is just as inconceivable as motion without matter. So here we get a very revolutionary breakthrough of the idea of what it is that actually causes, what the actual real relationships are in nature. It's motion in matter that causes these phenomena, that causes these properties that we see. Another big breakthrough was the discovery by Lavoisier of oxygen, the substance that caused or allowed combustion to happen. That combustion was fundamentally elements combining with oxygen to produce new elements. And this is very revolutionary, the idea that suddenly you had the idea of different substances being able to come together, producing new compounds with fundamentally different properties. In other words, a dialectical idea that the sum was more than its parts. The whole is more than the sum of its parts. The idea that what in Latin was called ignis mutat res, heat changes things. The fact that there is a development and an evolution to matter. And all of chemistry really is based on this idea of quantity and quality. The fact that as we add, for example, protons or electrons or neutrons to atoms, they fundamentally change in their properties. And the whole periodic table is based around this idea, the periodic table developed by Mendeleev. We see that compounds themselves, just the addition of extra atoms, can fundamentally change the whole properties of materials as well. And what we see, therefore, is that the properties that we see in nature are not intrinsic or inherent to things, but are arising out of the interaction between things. Properties, really, are not something inherent or intrinsic, but express relationships. So going back to that dialectical idea that it's relationships between things that are key. And we see that, again, the example of thermodynamics, with the example of gases, the fact that we can talk about properties such as temperature and volume and pressure, but these are properties that arise out of the interactions, the infinitely complex interactions of molecules that are themselves unpredictable, but yet these definite properties arise due to the relations between things. Now, modern science has vindicated this dialectical view of nature even further. We see in all the kind of examples of modern science that change is not something smooth and linear, but actually all change occurs in nature in a dialectical way. You have periods of stability of quantitative change beneath the surface that eventually expresses itself in what we call tipping points, the idea of sudden changes, qualitative changes. The theory of a modern theory of plate tectonics and earthquakes is an excellent example, where only discovered in the 1960s, the idea that the ground beneath our feet that we consider to be so solid and stable is in fact moving in a very slow and imperceptible way. And in certain places in the world where you have fault lines, this can express itself obviously in eruptions and earthquakes. In the field of evolution, you originally had the kind of mechanical but materialist explanations of Darwin that showed how change occurs in a biological sense. But what Darwin missed was the dialectical way of this evolution itself. And this was developed eventually by Stephen Jay Gould, a marvelous scientist who came up with the idea of punctuated equilibria, the idea that there are small mutations changing all the time in a given species. and that in periods of sudden environmental change, these can burst through into qualitative change, where suddenly new species develop. And in that sense, we see a dialectical development of biology and of populations themselves. I think the most striking and most kind of revolutionary example is actually the ideas of chaos theory themselves, kind of mathematical ideas, but also shown in many fields such as chemistry or population biology and so forth. It's the idea that that instability and chaos, far from being exceptions, are actually the norm in nature. And actually, stability that we do see is a dynamic equilibria, dynamic stability. For example, in chemical reactions, it's not a one-way process. But actually, you have reaction both back and forth, and that you these reactions can settle into these kind of dynamic equilibria. In populations, for example, we see as well that all the different species we see are interacting with each other in an ecological system, creating a kind of dynamic system there where populations rise and fall of different species against each other. So what these kind of revolutionary scientists were really trying to show, very influenced actually by developments, science in the Soviet Union and dialectical ideas, was the idea of order out of chaos. Again, this idea of simplicity and complexity being mutually interlinked. The fact that there is a chaos in the world, that we live in a non-linear world, to use the language of science. But that out of that, nevertheless, there is a certain predictability, there is structures, there is a certain simplicity and order that arises from the many interactions we see. And again, they gave the example of thermodynamic laws, where you have this chaos and random motion of molecules, but nevertheless, we can still talk about thermodynamic laws. We can still understand the properties of gases and actually manipulate those laws to our own advantage to create electricity and harness the amazing amounts of energy existing within these systems. Now, the beginning of the 20th century marked another fundamental breakthrough in the ideas of science. You had developments like quantum mechanics and Einstein's theories of special and general relativity that completely changed ideas of motion from the large to the small scales. Now, with these revolutionary breakthroughs also came problems, new unresolved questions that still remain unresolved to this day. In the world of quantum mechanics, we suddenly get a model of science, a model of nature that says that at the small scale, there's an inherent unpredictability within nature. That suddenly all the kind of deterministic clockwork view of the universe that we'd had with Newton is replaced by a kind of chaotic and random world where we've got uncertainty at the subatomic level. And this seemed to throw actually all the kind of old ideas about causality out the window. You know, if there's unpredictability, if we can't predict, does that mean that we can't predict anything? And therefore, can we even talk about science at all? Can we talk about cause and effect? And this actually upset and troubled a lot of scientists, including Einstein himself, who was famous for saying that God doesn't play with dice. He refused to accept the idea of this kind of inherent uncertainty in the world. And Einstein's theories of special relativity and general relativity themselves also kind of threw the established ideas into disarray, and actually still to this day have caused confusion on many issues. For example, he showed basically that changed our whole view of what space and time were, and showed that gravity, time, space and mass were all interlinked and mutually conditioned one another. That space-time is itself curved, he said, by the presence of matter. But then in turn, matter's motion was changed by the curvature of space-time. This kind of dialectical interlinking between space-time, matter and motion. They also demonstrate that by applying his equations of general relativity to the universe as a whole, he showed that our idea of a static universe, of this kind of eternal, unchanging universe, were itself impossible. That actually the universe itself must be dynamic and changing and evolving. And actually, this again troubled Einstein. He preferred the idea of a static and eternal universe. He didn't want to banish the idea of infinity. He considered the universe to be infinite. And therefore, in order to preserve the kind of eternality of the universe, which he thought from his own equations showed that it would just, because of gravity, the whole universe should eventually just collapse in on itself. He basically came up with something called the cosmological constant, basically a fudge to make his equations work so that you could remain the idea of a static universe. And eventually it was shown actually that the universe is actually dynamic, that the galaxies are moving away from each other. Hubble's observations demonstrated this. And the conclusion from these observations was that if everything's moving apart, if all the galaxies are moving apart now, then that must imply a point at which they were all at one point together. And this is where the evidence really for the Big Bang originates from, the idea of a supposed origin in the universe. But from the large to the small, from the quantum mechanics to the relativity theories of Einstein, there's contradictions that have emerged and at every scale. If we look at the large scale, in terms of the crisis of modern science, that's the title of today's talk, you can see enormous contradictions in the models that aren't hidden at all. People are aware of these. For example, 90% of the matter that should exist in the universe, 90% of the mass, rather, we can't see, we can't explain. The observations we have of the speed of galaxies show that there should be a hell of a lot more mass than we can actually see with our telescopes and with our observations. And therefore they've invented this term, dark matter, which explains the supposed 90% that's missing. And the search is for, at the moment, something called WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles. Now, basically, that means weakly interacting means something we can't see. Massive just means something that is literally containing a large amount of mass. So, apparently, out there are particles that we can't see. We can't detect them with any of our measurement devices, and yet they contain 90% of the mass that should be out there. And really, what you see, and at the other end of within the same kind of field, actually. You also have the problem that modern observations have shown that not only are galaxies moving away from each other, they're actually accelerating away from each other, which implies there's some sort of force pushing them apart. And this, again, has reintroduced the idea of the cosmological constant, the idea that there's something they call now dark energy that's actually repelling galaxies away from each other, an energy that they basically say arises from the emptiness of space itself. And really, with these kind of terms, dark matter, dark energy, you see, from a philosophical point of view, we're not really any further than the kind of animist idea or the kind of idealist conceptions I talked about earlier of just trying to describe phenomena by ascribing forces or spirits. You know, we're really not that much further away from saying that, you know, hotness is caused by the vis calorifica. Here we're saying, okay, there's all this anomalies we can't see. Well, let's just invent a term to describe it. And hence we end up with, you know, WIMPs or dark energy or dark matter, things that don't actually explain the faults in our models, don't actually arrive at a materialist explanation for the phenomena that we see. But all they don't solve the problem at all, but they merely push it back one step. They say, okay, we can't find matter. Well, that means there's something called dark matter. And that's the end of the story. But then you've got to then explain, well, what is it about dark matter? What are its properties? How does it arise? How does it relate to other things? And therefore the search is still on for an actual materialist explanation of these sorts of problems. We see it crop up today, very recently actually. They've shown evidence that suggests that not only is the universe expanding, but in its early stages, the very first few seconds of its existence, or what they suppose are the first few seconds of existence, the universe actually accelerated at an enormous pace, what they call inflation, universal inflation. And then the obvious question you have to ask is, well, what caused that inflation? And they've got a very clever answer for this. It's a particle called the inflaton. It's miraculous. You know, there we go. That's modern science for you. We can't explain something. We invent a particle and we give it a name that sounds just like the phenomena that we're trying to explain. And so really we don't get any further than just naming problems rather than actually solving them. And really, and in this respect, there is the fundamental problem of the Big Bang itself. This idea that there is even an origin of the universe. The idea, really, when you put it down to it, what they're talking about here is a beginning of time and space. A point before which there was nothing. We can talk of nothing. We can't ever know what was there. It's a barrier, if you like, to our actual knowledge of the universe. Now, Engels actually marvelously anticipated this whole question centuries ago in his discussions, his polemics against Turing, who also believed in the idea of a kind of an initial impulse, an initial mover that set the universe in motion, although obviously didn't call it the Big Bang at the time. Just on a side, actually, the idea, the term Big Bang was actually invented to ridicule the idea. It's invented by an English scientist called Fred Hoyle, who made it up as a, you know, to try, like, what, you think there was some sort of Big Bang that set the whole universe in motion? And it's actually stuck ever since then. But Engels actually, in his polemics against Turing, pointed out that it's nonsensical to talk about a beginning of time and space. And in other words, what you're talking about really is a beginning to matter and motion. We've seen Einstein's own theories show matter, motion, time and space, they're all inherently interlinked. You can't talk about matter without motion, equally as you can't talk about motion without matter. So the idea of something from nothing is both philosophically and scientifically pure nonsense. What you're talking about is really something from nothing, a kind of cosmological free lunch, if you like, in which before there was nothing, and then something out of nothing was created. But yet, at the same time, we know that there's a conservation of energy in the world, that you can't create or destroy energy. And yet here, you have they're saying all the energy in the universe was created at this single point in time, and everything was once concentrated at this single point, this infinitely dense point, which they call a singularity. And the point Engels made in responding to Turing was that you can't go from the static to the dynamic. You can't go from a situation of pure rest, pure stasis, to everything being in motion. Because that implies, actually, if motion is caused by force, as Newton pointed out, if it's forces that cause motion, then in order for the whole motion of the universe to be set in play, you would need a force external to the universe itself to set that motion into play. And that motion, that initial impulse, if you like, can only really be called a god. You know, it's fundamentally the same principle. And that actually shows, again, the kind of idealism of Newton's own views. That, you know, the idealism of this whole notion of the Big Bang, that there is something that could have set all this motion into play. The other major problem with the idea of the Big Bang is the fact that in order to talk about an expansion of the universe, we have to talk about a universe that has a boundary. For it to have an expansion, you must have an expansion of something into something. But again, the idea of an edge of space, if you like, is just as nonsensical as the idea of a beginning or an end in time. And actually, all of our scientific knowledge has constantly been one of actually expanding the known boundaries of the universe, expanding from our own planet to the solar system to the galaxies and beyond. And yet now, science has suddenly said, no, actually, there's an edge to space. There's an edge to what we can know. And there's a beginning of time, again, in the other direction, a beginning to what we can know. And anything outside of these boundaries is beyond our capability of knowledge. And in fact, there's a very anti-scientific view in general. Lenin actually points out, in a fabulous book called Materialism and Imperial Criticism, that the whole basis of science is that there's no such thing as the unknowable. There are just simply things that are currently not known to us. And the whole process of science is one of successive generations expanding our models, expanding our theories, expanding our knowledge, so that we have an ever and ever better approximation of the real nature of the world and of the universe. This idea of the boundary to the universe also fundamentally confuses the problem of what the universe is. When we talk of the universe, we're not talking of a thing that exists in and of itself. The universe is merely a name for all of the matter that is in motion, all of the substance in the universe, all of the energy and matter that there is. And this matter itself is infinite, not in the sense that it's infinitely enormous. Obviously, we're composed of finite things, but there is an infinity of that of those finite things. That is the real nature of the universe. It is the collective word for the infinite amount of matter that exists in all directions and in all time. An infinity of finite things that is itself constantly changing. Now, really, it's this concept of infinity that's actually confused and upset scientists, actually, if you like. They can't, like, mathematicians can't handle the idea of infinity. It's a contradiction in their equations, and they try and banish it. But actually, you see, in the process of banishing infinity, these very same scientists have actually reintroduced it via the back door. Because if you're trying to get rid of the idea of an infinite time in the universe, then you have to have this beginning of time, this singularity. But what is a singularity? It's one over infinity. It's infinitesimal. It's the point at which density is infinite. It's the point at which all matter in the universe is concentrated in infinitesimally small point. So in other words, they've just reintroduced infinity into a different form in the process of trying to banish it. And Engels actually makes the point in talking to Turing. Infinity is part of nature. Infinity might be a contradictory idea, but nature is itself contradictory. Nature is dialectical, and it progresses through change, through contradiction. And we shouldn't therefore try and banish it, but actually embrace it. Now, even those kind of theories that have talked about an infinite universe, Einstein's personal preference to the idea of a static, eternal universe, or current theories that often talk about a kind of expansion and contraction of the universe, like a kind of lung inflating and reinflating and deflating. All of these actually themselves have quite a mechanical concept of infinity. Again, a very kind of Newtonian concept of infinity, of a clockwork that's just endlessly going round, never changing in its motion, just repeating the same sort of cycle like a pendulum. And that in itself is a very mechanical, undialectical view of infinity. But the other end of the scale, there's people who are upset by the idea of infinity because they consider within infinity the idea of randomness and chaos and things that just don't make sense. You get this idea, well, if there's infinity in the universe, then everything that could happen has happened, and in fact will happen, and has already happened, and is happening. And this kind of baffles people. In trying to resolve this problem of this kind of contradiction of infinity, what do you do when something with an infinitely small probability can occur an infinite amount of times? It should cancel out, and it will therefore happen. And the example that's often given is the idea of an infinite number of monkeys on typewriters bashing away will eventually produce the works of Shakespeare. But the point is, with this kind of crude idea of infinity that you often hear in relation to the universe, is the fact that we are not in a world that is completely random. We're not in a world that is devoid of all law and logic, and there's it's not, we're not monkeys bashing away a typewriter randomly. Within nature, within society, There are processes. There are things that have their own in kind of internal laws and logic that lead to certain kind of evolution and development. And there's a fundamental difference between therefore what is theoretically possible and what is actually probable and what is inevitable. These are completely different things. Just because something is theoretically possible does not mean it can ever actually happen. And we can see that in the case of biology, our own evolution as a species. It's not just the result of completely random mutations, but as was discussed yesterday in the talk on life and consciousness, we see that at a certain point, matter starts to develop its own laws and its own logic and proceeds from that to actually evolve within evolutionary laws. And therefore, we are not just the result of complete random mutations. Obviously, randomness does play a role in developing us as a species. Without the random mutations between one generation and another, you wouldn't have evolution at all. But that accident, if you like, reflects the necessity, the general process, the general laws and logic of evolution that arise at a certain point in the development of matter. So real infinity that we talk about in nature, real infinity that we talk about in the universe, is neither mechanical, it's neither a pendulum just going round or a clock endlessly cycling, nor is it this kind of complete chaos of random events. But a real evolution has to be seen in terms of dialectical development, of evolution, of change, of quantity and quality back into each other. You have, in other words, a unity of opposites between the new and the old, between patterns on the one hand, but new developments that will arise also, between order and chaos, novelty and repetition, accident and necessity. All of these things are interrelated in a real understanding of what the infinity of the universe actually displays. And I think a very good example of this is to look at the weather. You know, the weather obviously has a certain randomness to it. No 2 days are ever exactly the same. And yet there is obviously still general limitations within what the weather can ever do. You know, if we woke up and it was 100 degrees centigrade, you'd think probably the sun has exploded. But and so obviously there is a limit to what the weather can do. There are laws and logic within meteorology. But yet obviously there is no 2 days are ever the same. There is an infinite variation, if you like, within this law, within this kind of evolution of our climate and our weather. Now at the small scale, as well as the problems of the cosmology at the big scale and the big bangs, at the small scale, these quantum mechanics has also introduced massive contradictions and problems that still haven't been resolved. As I said, it introduces this idea of inherent uncertainty in the universe. And particularly, this was pounced upon by the idealist scientist, Heisenberg, who was very well known for his idealism, who basically said that as a result of the unpredictability at the subatomic level, we could never predict anything, that there was no causality, no predictability. In other words, basically no scientific method was possible at all. And at the same time, within quantum mechanics, there's a very subjectivist idealism that's crept in. Subjectivist idealism, this idea, you know, to put it, kind of famous aphorism, you know, if a tree falls in the woods and no one's around, does it still make a sound? Now, this is the kind of logic of quantum mechanics, that actually things exist in all states in this perfect superposition of different states. There's no objective reality, if you like, until we come along and observe the system and the so-called waveform of a particle collapses and it achieves a definite state. Now, this was called the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics that people like Bohr and Heisenberg subscribed to. And it was mocked, actually, by Schrödinger. Many of you will have heard of the idea of Schrödinger's cat. And actually, this was used as a thought experiment to show the ridiculousness of the Copenhagen school. Schrödinger saying, well, you know, imagine if I put my cat in a box, you know, all animal cruelty concerns aside. If I put my cat in a box and introduce some radioactive element that I can detect the breakdown of, but upon detecting the breakdown, that sets a mechanism in play that kills my cat. Now, if I close up this box after a certain amount of breakdown of this radioactive material, which is itself a quantum process, you know, my cat will either be alive or dead, depending on how much of it's broken down. But until I observe the box, is it alive or is it dead? Now, according to the Copenhagen school, it's both alive and dead at the same time. And it's only upon opening up the box that we can say that the cat actually achieves a state of death or life. And the whole point of this thought experiment is to show the ridiculousness of this idealistic viewpoint, this subjectivist idealistic viewpoint. Because at what point can we go from the micro scale of the atomic level to talk about uncertainty at the macro scale? Just because there's uncertainty at the subatomic level, does that mean there's now uncertainty about the whole of the world, about the macro world that we live in? And the problem with the whole this kind of school of quantum mechanics is the fact that it fails to recognize that obviously all experiment is a process of interaction. Of course, every time we observe nature, we interact with it. Every time we try and peer into the inner connections of nature and discover the causes behind phenomena, that is necessarily a process of interaction. And that's what experiment is. And Engels points that out again in his writings on this, pointing out that, you know, science itself is the product of labor. It's the product of us manipulating our environment and our surroundings, of using our hands and our tools to discover the situation, the real nature of the world. And just because there's an unpredictability at a certain level, because we don't know necessarily about the mechanisms within that phenomena, It doesn't mean that we can't talk about predictability at other scales at all. Statistical randomness doesn't mean that there's a kind of unknowable barrier at all. As we said, there's no such thing as the unknowable, simply what we do not yet know. And again, as I've explained earlier, there is a relationship between the kind of chaos of unpredictability that we see at certain scales and necessarily an order that arises out of that. Even within quantum mechanics, you can't predict exactly the behavior of individual particles, but nevertheless, there are experiments that show on mass at an aggregate level, you can make predictions about the patterns that particles will form if they're fired through the single or double slits, for example. In other words, out of randomness, we see a certain predictability. Now, on the subatomic level, you have the problems associated with the idea of trying to find fundamental particles. You know, this is the quest of particle physics, to keep trying to find the fundamental particle. And again, they encounter the same problems of thinking that we can somehow get to the very root of nature, as though there is a root. Just as the universe is infinite in the infinity of matter at a universal scale, so also as we delve into matter, into nature, and go delve deeper, there is no limit there to how deep that can go. There is just a limit to our scientific abilities at any time to observe and analyze the problem. Again, both on the small scale, nature is infinite. It is an infinite series, if you like, of finite things within every atom. You know, used to, the word atom itself meant the indivisible in Greek, the indivisible. But now we know that the atom is composed of protons, electrons, and neutrons. And then breaking that down, we know that the neutrons and the protons themselves are the product of quarks. And we can keep going further, and science will go further. But at the moment, the search is still for what they think of fundamental forces. And this is spilled over into the rest of particle physics and the idea of there being also fundamental forces. And one of the big problems actually facing science is the idea of how to explain the kind of fundamental forces that we see in society. Three fundamental forces, the strong and the weak nuclear forces and the electromagnetism, all are explained by our standard model of particle physics. And alongside that, the standard model tries to explain not only the three fundamental forces, but the origins of mass, the explanation for mass. And I'm sure many of you will have heard about the search for the so-called God particle, the Higgs boson, that they think is the particle that explains mass. Now, all of this search for fundamental forces and fundamental particles and fundamental forces and the explanation for mass, all of this actually... The problems they're encountering also arise out of the kind of Newtonian paradigm of science, which talks about everything in terms of forces and mass. You know, the idea of F equals ma. We're stuck with this idea of a force being something external to matter, being external to objects. That objects themselves are passive, and forces externally impose themselves on matter. And at the same time, we have this idea of within the Newtonian paradigm, mass being the resistance to motion. Again, as I say, F equals ma, force equals mass times change in motion. And this is actually a very idealistic concept of motion, of matter, because the point is that these kind of terms in the equation, F, M, and A, they're not real, tangible things. Any equation is an abstraction. Any terms and parameters and properties that we talk about, they're abstractions of a real dynamic process of interaction and dynamism. And therefore, we can't explain mass and force, these abstract terms that we've created to describe nature and to describe motion. We can't explain these ideas of forces and mass just by assigning them particles. You know, today they say, well, the force of electromagnetism is the photon, and the mass itself is just created by the Higgs boson. Now, again, to go back to what I said earlier, this is basically the same as saying, something is hot because it possesses the property of hotness. You know, it's a tautological statement to say a force is due to a force-carrying particle. You haven't explained the real nature of these things. It's back to the realm of the res calorifica. And it's exactly the same as the wimps and the dark energy that we talked about earlier. They're not explaining phenomena with these terms. And Engels summed this up in Dialectics of Nature. He said there's a tendency in science, in how we look at the world through this Newtonian method, he said, to invent as many forces as there are diverse phenomena. In any words, if we can't explain something, we just give it a name. In terms of the Higgs, for example, there is a dialectical element to it in terms of it. They say mass arises due to the interaction of this boson with matter and the Higgs field, which they say. But again, no explanation of what the field is, what the boson is, what properties they have, why do they interact with each other in this way, and how does that explain the mass that we see? Again, going back, for us as Marxists, as materialists and dialecticians, we see the properties like mass. Mass is a property, ultimately, of matter. It's a property that arises due to the relationship between matter itself. It expresses, really, the idea of mass, this abstract term that we've invented for our equations, for F equals ma. It expresses a relationship between interactions of matter. It's, as with all properties, it's not intrinsic to matter, but it's something emergent, something that arises from it, like the properties of a thermodynamic system, like the colour of objects that we talk about. You know, once upon a time, colour would it be explained by something possessing the properties of red or the properties of green. Now we understand colour as an interaction between the photons of light, the object that it bounces off, and obviously also our own sensory organs and how we perceive that colour. You know, you can apply the same kind of philosophical problem to societal issues. You know, we talk about human nature as though there are inherent properties within humans. But obviously, as Marxists, we don't see human nature as something intrinsic within people, but something that arises due to our social relations, our social interactions. The idealists in the economics field talk about, you know, commodities having intrinsic value because of supply, you know, marginal utility and so on, rather than, again, seeing value as something that is emergent, an emergent property due to the interaction of commodities and an expression, really, of the social labour time put into these things. Now, as I hinted at earlier as well, all these problems on the small scale and the large scale interact with each other to the point where the real barrier in science now, the real question they're trying to answer, is how to reconcile these seemingly irreconcilable theories of quantum mechanics on the one end and general relativity at the other. And the question arises, how do they combine all these forces, these four fundamental forces they come up with, the three that I discussed earlier on the small scale, and at the large scale, gravity. Why is gravity so weak as a force, but yet the other force is so strong? There's no explanation in the models, and they for decades now, they've been seeking a way of reconciling these two theories. And again, the problem arises from a Newtonian paradigm of how we view forces and you know, the idea of force as something external to matter in motion. The point is that there aren't fundamental forces, just as there aren't fundamental particles. There aren't fundamental forces. Forces and the laws, actually, these whole models, you know, we can't really talk about a theory of everything. That's what they're trying to come up with, basically, a theory of everything that explains all our different laws and how they relate to each other. There isn't one set of laws that can be used to describe all of nature. We have, what we see is different interactions, different laws, if you like, different dynamics of matter at every level. In other words, you have a transformation of quantity into quality. At new levels, new laws arise that describe matter in motion. In other words, again, the whole is more than the sum of its parts. You know, we can't, for example, just using physics and chemistry, describe the behavior of individuals or of populations or of evolution. New laws, as I said, emerge in terms of the evolution of species that are fundamentally different from those laws of physics and chemistry. And at the same time, we can't take Darwinian ideas and apply them to understand society and the economy. There are those who try to, these kind of, you know, these very right-wing types, actually, who try and paint the economics field as being a struggle of all against all, like we're some sort of, barbaric species that hasn't developed civilization. But obviously, actually new laws do arise in society, in history, in the economy, that can't be explained by the laws that we have at other levels. And this really brings up the question, well, what is a law? What is what do we mean when we talk about a law, whether it's in science or in society? Our concept of a law that we generally think of in science is, again, inherited from Newton's, this idea of something that exists actually outside of nature and is imposed on nature, the idea that there's some sort of godly, eternal motion that's like written into the fabric of the universe, if you like. You know, if only we knew the laws of the universe and all the initial conditions, we could set our clockwork universe and put in motion and predict the future exactly. In other words, laws and a Newtonian sense are idealistic. They're imposed on the nature. It's like there's a computer programmer in the sky who's kind of tapped out the laws of the universe and set all the parameters, again, abstract parameters, and press play and then watches the whole thing unfold. Again, it's this whole clockwork universe idea of the Newtonian paradigm. As Marxists, as dialecticians, as materialists, our laws are the opposite. They're not imposed on nature, they're not external to nature, but they arise out of the interactions and of the relationships, the real relationships we see in nature. In other words, really, to be more precise, for us, all laws really are tendencies, is probably a better way of putting it. In other words, they express the fact that in general, if you have similar conditions of this type, you will get similar results. Although even now with chaos theory, we know that initial differences in initial conditions, because of the non-linearity, because of the dialectical nature of processes, can actually lead to very different outcomes. So for us, really, laws are emergent. As I say, they're generalizations, abstractions of real processes that we see that emerge from the real interactions of matter and motion. And therefore, all our kind of laws, all our models, all our approximations and theories, all our theories are approximations, all our models are approximations, and describe phenomena at a certain scale within certain limits. And the whole process of science, as I said earlier, is one of trying to constantly expand these theories, expand these models, to be able to come to better and better approximations of a nature that is infinitely complex. And that's the point. Nature is infinitely complex, but yet there is a simplicity, there is an order that arises that we can know about, and that we can abstract and generalize. And our whole process is to improve the accuracy of those approximations. And really, if we're going to talk about a theory of everything, that's nonsensical. You know, there is a different matter, the different laws apply to the motion of matter at the subatomic level than they do at the cosmological level. And the only real theory of everything, therefore, the only real most general law that we can come up with is precisely what I described right at the beginning. The general laws of motion in nature, in society, in thought, which, as Engels said, are best represented in the ideas of dialectics. Now, really, modern science, as the title of this topic suggests, is in a crisis, and particularly in this field of cosmology and theoretical physics. There's a real cul-de-sac that's been that the scientists are going down, where for decades now, they've come up with you know, theories that are more and more abstract, more and more theoretical, but can't actually be proven with any real science. You've actually got theories that aren't scientific at all in the fact that they're not in any way testable. You've got things like string theory and so forth that are trying to create a theory of everything that are just mathematical models, purely abstractions, and they can not only have they not been proven, they can never be proven. And therefore, it gives an excuse for scientists to just continue going on, building conjecture upon conjecture, model upon model, and yet never actually getting any closer to a real explanation. And it's really modern physics in this sense, theoretical physics, has gone down an extreme form of idealism. There's always, actually, Engels explains, a tension within science, precisely because of the separation of mental labour from manual labour. There's always a tendency for idealism to creep in, precisely because the scientific community is generally quite withdrawn from the real needs of society, from the actual processes going on in society. But it's become to an extreme form in the term of theoretical physics, where basically now it's the maths that's seen as primary, rather than our mathematics being understood as an abstraction of the real processes in nature. Now it's the inverse. What is primary, what is most important, is the beauty and the elegance of our equations and of our models. And actually equations and theories are judged purely on the basis of that kind of aesthetic, if you like. And you've got these, as I say, abstractions built on abstractions. One of the most popular debates in theoretical physics now is how many hidden dimensions are there? Do we live in a four-dimensional world? No, actually, the current theory says maybe 11 or 12 dimensions or maybe 13. And then if the maths doesn't quite work with that, well, to hell, let's just keep adding a few more dimensions. What does it matter? If we've gone from four, we might as well just keep going. And there's even theories now saying 500 dimensions, an infinite amount of dimensions. Every time any event happens, it creates another universe, a multiverse, they call it. You know, and all of this kind of nonsense that really, it sounds like the old medieval priests discussing the idea of how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. It's a complete abstraction from any real, observable, testable science. And it's fact, it's not science at all. Now, the point is, it's not just us as Marxists pointing out these problems. These problems in modern science are well known. And there are already people in the scientific community, established, well-known, well-respected professors, coming out and saying exactly the same sort of things as this. Just want to give one example. By a theoretical physicist called Carlo Rovelli, who was asked, what he thought the main problems facing science were. He's a theoretical physicist himself. He says, theoretical physics has not done great in the last decades. Why? Well, one of the reasons, I think, is that it got trapped in a wrong philosophy. The idea that you can make progress by guessing new theory and disregarding the qualitative content of previous theories. This is the physics of why not. Why not study this theory or another? Why not another dimension, another field, another universe? Science has never advanced in this manner in the past. Science does not advance by guessing. It advances by new data or by a deep investigation of the content and the apparent contradictions of previous empirically successful theories. But most of current theoretical physics is not this sort. Why? Largely because of the philosophical superficiality of the current bunch of scientists. Now, one of Rovelli's colleagues, actually a physicist called Lee Smolin, wrote a very good book recently called Time Reborn, where he echoes many of these same problems, basically saying that the real problem facing science isn't that we lack facts and data and the tools to investigate these problems, but actually the real problems are a philosophical one, that we're trapped in the wrong paradigm, in this Newtonian paradigm, in this quite mechanical and idealistic paradigm that tries to explain the universe in the same terms that we can talk about an isolated system that we've set up within a laboratory. The idea of our models somehow and equations being primary and external to nature. The idea of somehow there being a theory of everything that can explain all of the phenomena. And what Smolin says actually is that fundamental to all these problems is that they've expelled time, he says. Expulsion of time from our understanding of nature, he says, is that the key to things. And really what he's hinting at there is the idea that we've expelled change from our theories of the universe. We've expelled dialectical change, the idea of how motion and matter interact. And this is really the barrier to progress that's been erected. And it's the same as that identified by Thomas Kuhn in his talk about scientific revolutions. There is a massive vested community in this scientific community that will not allow there to be new models proposed. That it's very hard, actually, to even get a place at conferences where these sort of things are discussed, because the people organising the conference don't want some sort of heretic coming in who threatens to undermine the pride fundamentally, and also, more materialistically, their access to funding, their own livelihoods. And Engels actually showed the very importance of philosophy in addressing the problems of science. We just discussed yesterday about his pamphlet, The Part Played by Labour in the Transition from Ape to Man, in which he showed the materialist explanation for how actually it wasn't the brain that led to the development of the hand and of tools, but actually vice versa. It was our ability to stand upright, to free our hands, to interact with nature, to develop tools, that then forced the brain to expand, and it's the interaction between the two that developed our brain capacity that then gave a further development to our ability to abstract and manipulate nature. The problem was, Engels was completely ignored in his theories, and so for over 100 years, people were completely looking the wrong way round for the, what fossils they should be looking for. They were looking for a big-brained animal that preceded an animal that used tools. And in fact, eventually, Engels was proven right and actually found that it was a small-brained animal that had begun to use tools that came first, and only later do you see evidence for bigger brains in the skeletal anthropological records. And what this shows, really, is the fundamental point of having the right philosophical outlook. We as Marxists don't say that we've got all the scientific knowledge or all the mathematical tools to provide a fully worked out alternative to the problems of science. But what we can say is that as Marxists, with a correct method, a scientific method at root, we can at least point out the contradictions in current theories and point out the direction that science should be looking in order to progress forwards. In other words, today what we really need is a modern day paradigm shift in which philosophy, and by that we mean the way we observe, analyse and explain the world, can and in fact must play a fundamental role, and therefore there must be a fundamental change in outlook. A new scientific revolution based, I would say, on the scientific and revolutionary ideas of dialectical materialism.